Amen. Great to see you today. It's a beautiful day. It's always good to gather together. It's a day like this that you look out there and you're so grateful that you didn't follow your friends to Texas to get a bigger yard. No, I feel bad for them. But it's always good to gather together. But today is special because we're going to start a new study. We finished Acts last week, if you weren't with us. And now we've come to the book of 1 Samuel. We're going to go through the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, which are exciting times in the history of Israel. It's where the beginnings of what became the kingdom of Israel started. And you might go, yeah, but Israel, I mean, Saul was a terrible king. They shouldn't have had a king. But remember, when we're reading the story of the kingdom of Israel, we're reading the story of the kingdom that led to, that will lead to, the ultimate reign of Messiah himself. And so these are exciting times to look back in the beginning at how all of this got going. Now, just to get a historical and biblical context of where we are when we come to the book of 1 Samuel. If you look at the Bible, you have, like, it starts with the book of Genesis. Genesis, if you want to remember an outline of Genesis, is it's four great events and four great men. So the events are creation, the fall, the flood, and the Tower of Babel. And those four events take the first 12 chapters of Genesis. Then the rest of the whole book, the other 38 chapters, are four great men: Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. So at the end of Genesis, it brings us to where the children of Israel are in Egypt, where they ultimately become slaves. So all of that's Genesis. Then there's Exodus. Exodus is when Moses leads them out of Egypt after 400 years of slavery and leads them to Mount Sinai there in the desert to receive the law. And so that's Exodus. Leviticus happens at Mount Sinai. It's a listing of the entire law. Then you come to Numbers, which is them wandering in the desert for 40 years after receiving the law. And so that book is from Sinai to ultimately right to the edge of the Jordan, but not crossing. And then Deuteronomy is a rerun that Moses gives them before he dies. Then he dies, and then you have the book of Joshua, which Joshua is the one that led them across the Jordan into the promised land. And during the book of Joshua, they began to conquer the land, divide it up among the tribes and things like that. Then you get to the book of Judges, and you have these periods of time where the children of Israel rebel against God. Somebody comes in and mops them up. They cry out to God. He raises up a judge or a deliverer or a leader who, for a short time, that leader will help them to have victory over their enemies until they get lazy and they begin to fall again. And so the book of Judges is this cycle of a strong leader who's usually kind of sketchy. They're not, you know, several of them are mentioned in Hebrews 11 because they did have faith, but they all have some really ugly underbellies as well. But the children of Israel, towards the end of the book of Judges, the last judge listed in Judges is Samson, who's a real mixed bag. And then you have a few chapters just telling you how bad it was. And then you come to 1 Samuel, where the judge now is a man named Eli. And then we will see Samuel to be born in this first chapter. And then Samuel will become the final judge of Israel before they have their kingdom beginning with King Saul, King David, King Solomon, and so on. So that progression. So to give you a timeline kind of an idea, if in Genesis 12, when you come finally to the time of Abraham, that was roughly 2000 BC. So with creation being somewhere in the 4000s BC, we don't know exactly at what point that happens. Then you have 2000 BC is Abraham. That's a huge pivotal point in Genesis. Remember, you've got four events: creation, fall, flood, the tower, and you have four great men: Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. 2000 BC comes in the middle of that. Now, you get to the time of Abraham, you know, that's 2000. You get to the time of David, and that's 1000 BC. So the time between Genesis 13 and Abraham, God calling him in Ur, to the time when Jesus comes, you can divide that up between during all of that time. It's a 2,000-year period, starting with Abraham, and right in the middle is David. So it gives you kind of an idea of the chronology. And again, the books of the Bible, they're arranged very logically in terms of here's creation bringing you up until the children of Israel. Here's the children of Israel leaving Egypt, coming to Sinai. You know, Leviticus is the reciting of the law. Numbers is wandering around the desert. And Deuteronomy is a review. And then Joshua is conquering the land. And then the book of Judges is them being knocked around, delivered by, at first, its various Canaanite cultures like the Midianites and people like that. Towards the end, there are some people named the Philistines who become the greatest opponent of Israel. And partly why the Philistines were such a thorn in the craw of the Jews is because the Philistines, who, by the way, they weren't the whole Palestinian thing that we call those guys in the Gaza Strip and on the West Bank. They call themselves Palestinians because they're trying to identify with the Philistines. They're claiming that their ancestors were there in the land before the Jews came. It's not true. It's been disproven genetically. The people called Palestinians nowadays are those who are, they're just of Arab descent, and it, you know, that can be proven. The Philistines were actually Europeans from the island of Crete. And we know that from archaeology and things like that. Remember the island of Crete where Paul, you know, had a ministry happening. The reason why the Philistines were so powerful, and we'll see it as we move forward through the story, is that being from Crete, which is off the coast of Greece, the Greeks had developed metallurgy to where they were like, you know, they had their own version of forged in fire. They're making, you know, weaponry, you know, with iron and things like that, that it was really hard to fight against them with a spear with a wooden stick on it. And so they brought that weaponry in, which really presented a problem for Israel, until ultimately, finally, David will lead them to the point where he can pretty much eliminate them and wipe them out. But that's the point of time that we are in here. Now, the last couple chapters of Judges let us know that it was really a dark time in the history. I hope I didn't lose you on that. I know I'm talking fast, but it's I'm making up for all your years of bad public schooling. But just kidding. But especially when I look out and like some of you went to school at Calvary and I'm like, ooh. But the place is a mess spiritually. And even at this point, the place where they worship God, which the temple hadn't been built yet, Jerusalem really wasn't a thing. It was just a village at this point. The worship was happening in Shiloh, which is up in today what we would call the West Bank. And it was a tabernacle. God had had them build a tent. So they went to Shiloh in order to worship God and perform the ceremonies and the rituals of the law and all that kind of stuff. So here in 1 Samuel, you have a man, Elkanah, who was a Levite, but it says that they called him an Ephraimite. He lived in the mountains of Ephraim. Levites had villages surrounding each of the 12 tribes of Israel. And so even he wasn't of the tribe of Ephraim, but he lived there by Bethlehem, which is, again, a little north of Jerusalem in the southern part of what became the northern kingdom later, the tribe of Ephraim. So Elkanah, we pick up his story here in verse 1, gives his genealogy a little, and verse 2, right away, here's the problem. And he had two wives. What could possibly go wrong with that? I mean, and people will go, and some of these people that live in these weird Mormon cults and everything today that have multiple wives, they're like, the Bible doesn't forbid it. In fact, it's, you know, some of the greatest people in the Bible were polygamous. It's true. And every single time, it ended up being a stupid idea. And God allowed it because it was a part of their culture. But at the same time, you can't show me a single case in the Bible where having two or more wives was a good idea. Just a stupid idea. Keep that in mind. You know, if you're married to the same person, if you can hang in there, some marriages fail, for sure. So I'm not going to say that this is always the case. But anyone who's been divorced and remarried and they still have a spouse out there running around, you understand what happens when it's like, no, you know, once you complicate this relationship, it really does deteriorate. And in his case, it certainly did. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. But the man went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Also, the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. Eli was the judge. He was also the high priest. He had two sons that we're going to read about later in the book. Why it mentions them here without saying anything else about them is just to let you know, plant a seed in your mind. Remember these two sons, these two priests who are sons of Eli, because they are complete dirtbags. It's mentioned here because it tells you something about Elkanah, that he's going to go worship the Lord, and it doesn't matter if Shiloh is corrupt. It doesn't matter if the leader, the priest, is weak, and his sons, the other priests, are dirtbags. And they certainly are. You'll see it next week. But he's like, I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for God. Now, there will always, it's frustrating to be a Christian sometimes, because you look at other Christians and you look at ministers, you go, oh, I really looked up to that guy until this came out about him and that happened. And it's like, you know what? It's never been about the people. It's always been about the Lord. And Elkanah understood that, and it's a good reminder for us as well. So whenever the time came, verse 4, for Elkanah to make an offering, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, although the Lord had closed her womb. So the sacrifices that it's talking about here are probably what was called the peace offering. Normally, you'd bring a sacrifice for a sin offering or something like that. You'd give it, they would burn it, you're done. But a peace offering was something that they would barbecue it. Some of it would go to God, the priest would eat some, and the people who brought it would partake in some. It's like it was a time of fellowship and connection in this way. So you have this family, one wife, bunch of kids, really proud of herself, loved it, you know, and her husband loved her, but her husband had this other wife, Hannah, who was like, you know, she was really hurting because she wasn't able up until that point to conceive children. And that's a real source of pain, as many of you, and you all know people who they want to have babies so bad and it just doesn't happen. And you're like, how do you deal with this? It's painful. It's hard. Pastor Ken told me 1 in 6 couples has problems with fertility. And so he's got this dilemma going on, but as we read on, he loved Hannah and would give her double what the other wife, Peninnah, would get. So he's showing clear favoritism, but that wasn't helping her at all. No matter what you do for someone when they have that desire and that drive, it doesn't make up for it. And her rival also provoked her severely to make her miserable because the Lord had closed her womb. I mean, that's natural. You get two or more wives and they're going to compete and they're going to hate each other. They're going to do that. Again, any of you that have an ex-wife or an ex-husband, you know how this works. It's just not, we're not designed to function well that way. And so that was happening. But year after year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, she made it worse for her. And then Elkanah, he makes a real man-type statement here. He said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? Why don't you eat? It's good. And why is your heart grieved? What's your problem? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? What a dumb thing to say. But it's the kind of thing a man would say, like, oh, you're sad, you don't have a kid. Look, you have me, and you still have your figure. Look at her. So to him, it's like, what's your problem? Is there something about a mom that's separate, that's different than that? And so Hannah arose after they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh. Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the tabernacle of the Lord. The seat that he is sitting on is the seat was actually the throne, literally, that was where the judge who was ruling over Israel would sit. People could come to him and he would solve their problems. They called them judges because one of the things they would do is two people can't get along, they would try to mediate it. So poor old Eli is sitting there on the seat by the doorpost of the tabernacle of the Lord. And she, Hannah, was in bitterness of soul. She was just felt horrible. And she prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish. Then she made a vow. So she's praying intensely. Now, the Bible makes a lot of references to the fact that when you're praying, you should be really invested emotionally in what you're praying for. The Bible makes a difference between someone who's praying with deep passion and somebody who's just like, yeah, bless everybody, make it a good day, all those kinds of prayers. So she's like focused and intense, and she's praying, and she made a vow to God, and she said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, and not forget your maidservant. Remember me, I'm here. But will give your maidservant a male child? Then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. She's desperate. And so in those days, they had a vow, according to the law, called the Nazarite vow. And it was something that generally a person would do for a period of time. They would say, like, God, I'm going to focus on you for the next month. And during that time, as a sign of my Nazarite vow, I will not, I'll not touch wine or any kind of grapes at all. I'll just completely abstain from it. So it's not even a question. At the same time, I'll stay away from dead people. I won't get near dead bodies. A big sacrifice, right? But it might be if it was somebody who's going down in battle or whatever, but that was a part of the Nazarite vow. But the other thing is, and you don't cut your hair while you've taken the vow. Now, it's a nice thing to do to show devotion to God, but this is different. This is like from the time he was born, he will be a Nazarite for the rest of his life. Now, that was almost unprecedented. There's only one other time in the Bible where someone took a Nazarite vow for life, which ironically is the last judge before Eli, and that was Samson. He didn't stick to it very well. I mean, he certainly drank when he wasn't supposed to. He killed a bunch of people, so it's hard to stay away from dead bodies when you do that. And ultimately allowed his hair to be cut while he was asleep, which you can't necessarily blame him totally for that one. But so here's somebody saying, I want a child so badly that I will commit him to you forever. By the way, Jesus was not a Nazarite, didn't take a Nazarite vow. I hear pastors say this like, oh, Jesus couldn't have drank wine because he was a Nazarite. No, Jesus was a Nazarene. That means he's from the city of Nazareth. He was not a Nazarite, never called a Nazarite. Two different words. So she makes this commitment. I'll commit him to you, and he will serve you. And that was a big, bold thing. But you go, well, she didn't have a kid, so is she actually going to do it? But it happened as she continued praying, verse 12, before the Lord, that Eli saw her mouth moving. Hannah spoke in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore, the conclusion that Eli came to was, this lady's drunk. Now, you think somebody's in church, she's in the tabernacle where you come to worship God and meet God, and she's crying and her lips are moving, but you don't hear her saying anything. This shows how weird and how fallen the worship was at this time in Israel, is that the assumption is she must be drunk. Now, we see other examples in the scripture of people coming to the tabernacle drunk, we see like Hophni and Phinehas doing horrible things at the tabernacle, illicit things that we'll see as we keep going through the book. But that was that's the discernment of the leader of Israel at this point was, she's in church, she's crying, I see her lips moving and I don't hear anything, must be drunk. And so he confronted her and told her to stop drinking. And Hannah answered, verse 15, and said, "No, my Lord, I'm a woman of sorrowful spirit. My heart is broken. I have drunk neither wine nor intoxicating drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord." You ever been in a place where you just pour your soul out to God? It's a good thing to do. It leads to good things. When you just like, you just gush it out. Just let him know what you're thinking. Open up to him with all of the passion that you have within you. Don't hold back. He's not fragile. And she poured out her soul before the Lord. And then she says, "Don't consider your maidservant a wicked woman," or literally a daughter of Belial. They use the term a son of Belial or a daughter of Belial as being, somebody who's just really a bad person, really a negative influence, horrible person. We see it used a lot. It's kind of like a son of Belial or a daughter of Belial is like bikers and biker chicks. It's just, no, not really. But she goes, "I'm not one of those, seriously. For out of the abundance of my complaint and grief, I have spoken until now." And Eli's like, whoops. He said, "Go in peace." In other words, okay, just go. "Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition, which you have asked of him." He didn't even ask what she was asking. She didn't go, "I want a son so bad, and I promise to dedicate him to the Lord, and I'll be bringing him back here in a few years." No, it's just like, "I've been praying," and he's like, "Great." It's up to God to answer, and it is up to God. It's not up to people to understand us or to agree with us or whatever. But he said that, and she took it as being from God. And she said, "Let your maidservant find favor in your sight." So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. This is kind of amazing that here she has poured out her soul to the Lord. And now on the word of one guy who's clueless, who says, "May God grant you what you're asking for." She's like, awesome. She gets up and she's like, "Yeah, I'd like some of that double portion of meat now." You know, this would be a good time to do it because that's what faith is. When you ask something from the depths of your heart and then you act like God's actually going to do it, that you know that he's going to, and if he doesn't do it, that he has a great reason why he isn't. But now you've done what you can do. When you have a great desire for something, pour out your heart to the Lord. He will do what he's going to do. At least if he doesn't do what you want him to do, you'll know it's not because you didn't ask, that you didn't ask deeply from your heart. So, you know, she was like, okay, and she was ready to go and go ahead and move forward. And so they ended up, they went back home. And Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. It's not that he forgot her. That's just called an anthropopathism, where in order to understand God, you have to kind of impute human anthropos emotions, pathos, on him, because we don't have the language to describe God and all of his greatness. So there are anthropomorphisms where you use a physical image and you say, well, God spreads his wings. It doesn't mean God has wings. It's a figure of speech. So God, from outward appearances, it seems like, oh, he remembered. And so she had this son, called his name Samuel, which the name Samuel means God hears. And it says that, you know, "I asked for him from the Lord. Now the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and his vow. So the baby's like a few months old, but Hannah did not go up. She's like, "I'm not going back for worship until it's time for me to hand over this son that God gave me." And so she said, "Not until the child is weaned, then I will take him, that he may appear before the Lord and remain there forever." So The idea is I will nurse him, and once I wean him, then I'll go to Bethel and leave him there in the care of Eli. So we don't know how long that was before he finally went up. They would typically wean a child between 2 and 3 years, but in this case, I'm thinking she might have stretched that a little bit just because, you know, as soon as he's weaned, and then finally when his high school teachers were insisting, yeah. Elkanah said to her, "Do what seems best to you." This guy's finally wised up. "Okay, whatever you say, dear. Wait until you've weaned him. Only let the Lord establish his word." Then the woman stayed and nursed her son until she had weaned him. Now, verse 24, when she had weaned him, she took him up with her with three bulls. Now, it says three bulls here in our translation, but several of the other texts, including the Septuagint and others, say that with a three-year-old bull, which is probably more the case because that was a consecration, a sacrifice of consecration would involve bringing a three-year-old bull there. And it only says next that they sacrificed the bull. But it's either a three-year-old bull or three bulls, a couple of backups. But one ephah, flour, a skin of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh. And the child was young. He was still young. Then they slaughtered a bull, brought the child to Eli, and she said, "Oh, my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood by you here praying to the Lord." And he's like, "Oh, yeah, I think I kind of remember." Probably didn't. "For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore, I also have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he shall be lent to the Lord." So they worshiped the Lord there, and Eli's like, "I'm such a bad father. My own kids are dirt bags. Okay, fine." And he lets this happen. And then we'll see the story begin to develop in chapter 2 after Hannah prays a further prayer in the first part of chapter 2. And then we begin to see the story develop. So that brings us to the end of 1 Samuel chapter 1. So what do we learn from this chapter? There are a lot of lessons. As I mentioned, in case you didn't know, polygamy is stupid. And it's stupid for you to bring anyone else into your relationship other than the person that you've committed your life to. And you may justify, "Well, it's not that, or maybe we're this, or whatever." But it's like, this is what happens always. God never says, "Don't have more than one wife." He goes, "If you're going to have more than one wife, just see what happens." And every time in the Bible, it always worked out badly, and it always does in real life too. So if you can do it, one spouse is best, for sure. But we also see, and I love this in this chapter, the value of life. Like for Hannah, and even for Peninnah, you know, it's like life matters. Life is a treasure. Hannah, no matter what else she had, it wouldn't console her because she had such a strong desire to produce further life. She had such a desire for, and when you think about it, life is the most amazing miracle. It's the most amazing and mysterious phenomenon that there is in the world. The idea that you as a human with another human are able to propagate yourself, a better version of yourself, that can happen. You watch a child develop and you see that child come out and it's like, this is mind-blowing that I can have a mini-me. If you have kids and you look at your kids and you see yourself in them, and sometimes you go, "I hate that." But other times, though, you look at them and go, "I can't believe I made that." And I remember, man, when we had our kids, it was just, there was nothing I had ever experienced in life that was like that. And I think for the first one, you kind of don't think of it as much as a person until they're born and you're like, "Oh my." And then you know, it's like, that's a baby in there. That's a person that we made. It's crazy. It's just so powerful, this this mystery and power of life and genetics. It's, just, and then when you have grandkids, that's even better because you don't have to take care of it. But it's like, we made this, who made that? And I can't imagine loving a person more than somebody who came from me. And so they had that sense, they had that understanding. And now in their culture, they certainly had, they made a big deal about generations, about genetics. And that's why they would have these long genealogies, trace their roots and all that kind of stuff, and think about the generation that is to come and the ones who would come after them. It's why the promise to Abraham that to his seed, all the nations of the world would be blessed, going forward a couple of thousand years, and that meant something to him because they understood the miracle of genetics, the miracle of life, that it continues. And remember, it wasn't just like, oh, life begins at the moment of conception, like many people will say today. No, it begins way before that. It's the idea, it's the vision, it's being able to recognize what is coming down the road. In our culture, we tend to go, you know what? Oh, yeah, I know we're deficit spending, but it'll be my great, 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 great grandkids that have to pay off all of that. And that's their problem. I don't know them. If it was my kids or my grandkids, yeah, I just want us to get that far. The other ones, if I don't know them, it's not as big of a deal. That's kind of our cultural understanding. And yet, even with that, we're fascinated by, spit in a bottle and find out some of your roots. It's interesting. But in most other cultures, every other culture really in the world except our modern Western culture, it seemed that what we are doing matters because it will matter long after we are gone. And our culture tries to belittle that. It's why that abortion has become so popular in our culture, because we don't have an understanding of the value, the treasure of life, of genetic replication and what comes forth from that. And that's why ultimately I don't make a big deal about, okay, like anti-abortion because of the Bible. It has nothing to do with the Bible. I'm against abortion, but I'm against abortion because I'm in favor of life. And every single culture historically, from going as far back as you can, every single nation or people or whatever, they always had an understanding that the next generation matters. And when you lose that sense of the miracle of replication, then, of course, it just becomes less of a concern. And I think future generations will judge our generation and go, how in the world did you remove children from their mother's womb? And, late term is just completely, it's obscene. But in any case, how would you do that? Weren't you even realizing that that is your future? That life is a miracle and it matters? So anyway, I won't go on and on it, but it's not a biblical issue, it's common sense. You either believe in life or you don't. And not believing in life, you know what that becomes? It's not like, I'm not pro-life. If you're not pro-life, you're negative you. You are here because somebody before you believed in life going on. And that's why you're here. That's why we're all here. And ultimately, our future is produced by valuing and preserving life itself. So they understood that, and I won't harp on it anymore. But I also see in this story, how God hears anguished prayers. Again, pouring out your heart. If your heart is heavy, if there are things that you feel strongly about, a sense of great lack or difficulty, or you're feeling challenged, or life is just, it really stinks right now. Don't be afraid to get alone with God and pour out your heart. Really let him hear it. You don't have to word it in a special fancy way. You can say anything and it doesn't offend him. You read the Psalms that were inspired by God, and some of the things that David says are like asking God to shatter people's teeth and cut them off forever. He just wants to hear you pour out your heart. It's not about what you say. It's about this value that says, this is something that really matters to me, God. I'm being open with you. And so, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get the answer for your desires. You look at Hannah, she wanted a child really badly. She poured out her heart and she got a child. But again, like I said, one out of six couples have problems, you know, producing offspring. And so God doesn't every time do what you want him to do because he's God. You'd be God otherwise. But he wants to hear from you. He knows what's best for you, but he wants you to pour out your heart. It won't prove that he loves you or not. That's why Hannah was like, I'm submitting it to you. It's up to you. And I'm going to be okay. She prayed according to God's will. But the last thing that I want to call your attention to is the use of the word, I will lend him, in verse 28. I also have lent him to the Lord as long as he lives, and he shall be lent to the Lord. So they worship the Lord there. In what sense was she loaning him to the Lord? That word is an interesting word because it can mean to loan someone something, but it can also mean to borrow something from someone. And ultimately, it is generally used in a reciprocal understanding and relationship and connection, that he isn't totally mine and he isn't totally yours, but he's totally both of ours. It's kind of like if you go in, you know, with your neighbor to buy a lawnmower and you each pay for half of it. It's like it's both of your lawnmowers, but you can't take half of it and do anything with it. But it's part of both of you. And maybe that's a really inferior example, but the idea here is that she was saying, he'll always be mine. I'm not just giving him over to be sacrificed. I'm loaning him to you, God. And remember, he's always going to be my little boy, no matter what. And that's why we'll see later that she came every year, made him a new little coat and everything, and he was the best dressed little kid around the tabernacle because that's like her boy. But at the same time, he was God's boy. And at the same sense, yes, he belongs to God, but he would always also belong to her. And so it's the idea of entering in with a mutual understanding that he'll always be my boy, but he'll always be yours. And now, ultimately, this story reminds me of another story found in Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6, where Isaiah says, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. The government will be upon his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace, and of the increase of his government, there will be no end. God gave a child, but he was a son. He would always belong to the Father, but he was loaned to us, and he would become ours as well. And again, Christmas is such a beautiful picture of this. God gave his innocent little baby and said, here, I'm loaning him to you. He'll always be mine. He'll always be a part of me. Everywhere he is, I will be. And someday, you'll have to loan him back to me. Someday, you will have to release him. But you'll come sooner or later. You'll come be with us all, and we'll all be in here together, and we will all be related in this great, intimate connection that we have. You know, ultimately, you think about Samuel coming to this temple that's really corrupted, where they assume that if you're praying, you must be drunk, where Hophni and Phinehas are there taking advantage of women and everything else is being completely corrupt and stealing from the Lord and everything. And that's where you're sending your little boy? Well, think about it. Jesus, when he's born to Mary, she brings him to dedicate him where? The temple. The same temple where he would, you know, 3 decades later, be tried and convicted and sentenced to death on the cross. The same temple where, yeah, when he was a little kid, he came there and he could interact with these theologians, and later those theologians are the ones who would turn on him and want to destroy him. And ultimately, with all of that, there was a time when he came and said, this is my Father's house. It should be a house of prayer, but you guys have turned it into a swap meet. But it was the temple. It was where he came. It was promised that he would. And this story here in 1 Samuel and following through the book of 1 Samuel is so much a precursor to what would ultimately happen to the ultimate king of Israel, who would come out of the seed of David ultimately. Jesus belonged to heaven. He was loaned to earth. But when he was here, he belonged to us, and we returned him to heaven. And that the story of little Samuel is a beautiful picture of ultimately what God would do with his son, who wasn't literally his son. He used the metaphor of a father and child in order to help us to understand on a deeper level what that relationship was ultimately all about. So that's the first chapter. A question for all of us to reflect today is, do we value life? Do we think that life is a treasure? Do I believe that my own life and the lives of the people around me are things that are amazing? Do I believe that future generations matter? Do I believe in the lives, not just of my children and my grandchildren, but my grandchildren who are to come, and my great-grandchildren after that, and my great-great-grandchildren after that, and your great-great-grandchildren as well? Do I understand what a gift life is? Because God does. It's why he sent his son. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. And in that same chapter in John 3, he talked about birth as being the metaphor for the relationship change that happens between you and God when you are, in fact, born again. If you value life, first of all, if you don't value life, it comes and goes. I'd hate to be you. Because ultimately, then you're saying that you don't matter. And that's an awful conclusion to come to. People who think they don't matter, by the way, will always also decide that no one else matters. And all of the cruelty and ugliness in this world is due to people who forget that life is precious. And we're, you know, you can only decide that for you. I can only decide it for me. But if we value life like God does, then we understand, and I hope you know this, God values your life. God doesn't look at you as disposable. He doesn't look at you as a failed experiment. And whatever you've done in your life and however far you've wandered from God, he still looks at you like a parent looks at a child that they love and says, I still value your life. And you, no matter what's happened in your life, you are only a decision away from receiving from him his love and his forgiveness and becoming, now are we the children of God, becoming his family by allowing him to adopt us. He cares about you, and if you've lived your life thinking you don't matter, it's a lie. You do matter. Life is precious. Your life is precious. And I don't have to convince you that you're precious to me. You are. But the one who made you sees you as so precious that he loaned his only begotten son so that you'd have a chance at forgiveness and life forever. Jesus said, I came that you would have life and that more abundantly. If you've never received that life, if you've never recognized how much you are worth, today would be a good day for you to just say, wow, could that be true? Does he really value me that much that he would give his son for me? Does he really promise to give me a fresh start and to lead me into a deeper, richer life if I do life with him? It doesn't cost anything. You don't have anything to lose. You have a lot to lose if what I'm telling you is the truth. You don't have anything to lose if I'm wrong. It's not going to hurt you, because he's not asking you to do anything other than surrender to him. If you've never done that, I pray that you would today. And we'll have people up front who'd love to pray with you. If you'd like to start life over today, if the idea that you're worth something when people around you have tried to convince you that you aren't, but if that's something that's enticing enough that you're willing to give God a try, then come on down to the front. Let somebody pray with you. They're here if you need prayer for any reason, but man, especially if you want to become a child of God and recognize that you got where you are today because of an entire series of life givers who allowed you to get to this point. And now here is the message of God, that he loves you and he wants to forgive you and he wants you to understand you're worth way more than you ever suspected. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this reminder of how much you value life, because it tells us how much you value us. Thank you for demonstrating your love by giving the love of your life, the Son of God, so that he would give his life so that we could find new life, and then he would rise from the dead, letting us know that we can too. We thank you for this amazing story, Lord, as Samuel was loaned to you by his mom, as much as he meant to her, it made a beautiful picture for us to understand. So, Lord, we thank you for the beauty and the power and the majesty of life. Help us to value the lives around us. Help us to look at everyone that we see with the eyes that you have for them. That if they were the only person in this world, you would have given your son for that person to even just have a chance to find life. Give us those eyes. Give us that love for those around us. And help us to receive the love that you have for us. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.